This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 48 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be doing our Star Trek Essentials, the original series, season 3. Zachary, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's always fun to be able to sit and talk about Star Trek, the original series. That was the first Star Trek that I grew up on before the Next Generation, and it's actually the Star Trek I kind of go back to the least these days. You know, I really did grow up in the 80s and 90s and grew up in the Next Generation and into Voyager. But it all started with the original series with me. So I'm looking forward to diving in and talking about season 3 of the original series.
I am as well. As I've said many, many times, I grew up in the early 70s watching reruns of Star Trek, the original series. And I'm still very nostalgic about Star Trek, the original series. We're going to be talking about season 3, however, and Zachary, as many of our listeners, I'm sure, have opinions about this. Season 3 is not always a fan favorite.
Well, I think season 3 struggles a bit. You know, Gene Roddenberry had lost some creative control over Star Trek at that point, and I actually really do enjoy season 3. There's some really wonderful flights of fancy inside season 3. Fantastically science fiction oriented stories and fantasy oriented stories. I think they suffer a bit dramatically. They suffer a bit philosophically, but I actually really enjoy season 3, but I struggled to come up with my list of top picks for essential Trek philosophy today.
You know, it's interesting. We recently had Larry Nemechek on Metatrex, and I've heard Larry talk about season 3 of the original series in terms of, you know, having limited resources and just not a lot of creativity there. But I have to say that watching the third season of the original series, I am surprised at, even though they had limited resources, a lot of times they were recycling sets and recycling set pieces, and oftentimes, you know, a console that was used in this episode, they'll turn around and use it and repurpose it for another. And so I think in many ways, the third season of the original series was just a little bit more creative, I think, than previous seasons. I think they are a little light in some areas, but I will say that the more I watch the third season of the original series, the more I recognize these story threads, Zachary, that creep up from time to time in especially early seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, where they're almost telling identical stories, just, you know, changing, you know, characters and changing small threads within the story, but it's generally the same story. So I think there was some solid storytelling going on. I think they did raise some, you know, good, you know, philosophical questions, but, you know, I certainly understand the position that many fans have about the third season not being everything that they came to expect after seasons 1 and 2.
Well, I think it's generally well known that constraints can do one of two things. Constraints can either constrain your creativity, or, you know, working within constraints can empower your creativity. And I think that's what I see in season 3 of the original series, that the constraints that the series was under at that point actually helped inspire a degree of creativity In terms of the concepts for the episodes, things that may not have made it into the series otherwise, it is interesting to see the recycled stories in The Next Generation, because in The Next Generation, everyone had drunk the Gene Roddenberry Kool-Aid at that point. And so the stories take on a different tone in The Next Generation than they do in season three of the original series. But, you know, I like the constraints that were placed on season three. And you know, some of my favorite episodes of Star Trek are in season three of the original series. Mm-hmm. I just think of them as a little philosophically light and dramatically a little not as well developed or not as polished as you might get if Gene Roddenberry still had some creative control. But I'm not a season three original series hater. I really enjoyed the rewatch of the season.
Same here. Well, let me remind our listeners, Zachary, a little bit about what we do in our Philosophical Essentials. As our listeners should already be aware, we have kind of gone backwards in order. We've covered Enterprise, just going backwards in terms of the series. We did Enterprise, we did Voyager, we've covered Deep Space Nine, and then from Deep Space Nine, we went to The Next Generation, and then we covered with Aaron Harvey on our show just a little while back the entire animated series. And so we found ourselves to the original series, and we're going in reverse order. So we're starting with season three of the original series. And so next time we do one of these, we'll be back to Enterprise season three, talking about the Zindi arc. So we, you and I create a list of episodes that we find interesting from a philosophical point of view. You and I have not shared our lists, so there may be some areas in which our lists agree. You and I both have a list of five episodes. I started out with nine, but I pared it down to five episodes that I thought were interesting. And I will hint around a little bit and say that of my five, I know at least two of these episodes we've discussed in some length. And so I don't feel that I have a whole lot more to add to the discussion, and we'll refer our listeners back to previous episodes of Metatrex. But I do have my five episodes, and I'm interested to see what your list has as well. And I always pick up on new threads, Zachary, when we have these conversations, new things that I've oftentimes overlooked as I've done my various rewatches.
We should say for listeners who may be listening to us for the first time, these episodes of Essential Trek Philosophy do every fourth episode or so on Metatrex. And the goal here is not necessarily to have a deep dive into the philosophy in any one of these episodes. We do that most of the time on Metatrex. Any regular episode of Metatrex, we try to have an in-depth, fairly lengthy discussion on a particular topic or a particular episode. But for Essential Trek Philosophy, we're trying to hit the highlights. We want to give listeners an overview of the season as a whole and pick our favorite philosophically rich episodes. It could be a thread in an episode. It could be the overall theme of the episode, but don't expect the deep dive that we do on most episodes of Metatrex, but listen to almost any other episode of Metatrex if you want that deep dive. So with that said, I think, Mike, before we begin, you're actually forgetting the most important part of season three of the original series. If we hadn't had season three of the original series, we wouldn't have space hippies.
I got nothing else to say.
His brain is gone.
Take that. I can throw you for a loop once in a while.
You tripped me.
You're always throwing me for a loop, so it was fun to do it in turn. So there you go. Take that.
How do I come back from that? And Zachary, one other thing we should say on a more serious note is that we really invite our listeners to connect with us on social media, especially in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners only discussion group, in our show thread for this episode. Don't just take our word for it. We'd like to know what episodes were hits and misses with you, our listeners, as you watch them. What philosophical threads have you picked up on? Did you find interesting? Maybe it was an ethical dilemma or, you know, a particular moral play. Maybe it was, you know, one of those great philosophical problems or thought experiments that you saw kind of playing out in an episode. We'd love to hear about it. Definitely take to Facebook, the Babel Conference, and throw your two cents in.
Yeah, I don't think of us as having the final word on any one of these topics. I like to think of us as starting the conversation. You and I can get the ball rolling, do an overview of the philosophical content, the arguments for and against something. From there, it's up to the listeners to take it from there, keep the conversation alive, interact with us on Twitter and on the Babel Conference on Facebook, and you know, keep the conversation going. There's no chance we're going to resolve philosophical issues in an hour or an hour and a half on Metatreks, but I want to inspire people to take these ideas and these topics and these conversations, take up the baton on those and keep the conversation going and interact with us too. So yeah, absolutely. Send us your comments, send us your feedback, send us your thoughts on anything we've talked about. Find us on social media and keep the conversation alive.
Yes, as Quark would say, I'm always glad to take someone else's two slips.
Well, Quark would say, I'm all ears. I'm all lobes.
Right? I'm all lobes. Well, Zachary, do you want to start?
Absolutely. So my first pick for essential Trek philosophy from season 3 of Star Trek, the original series, in no particular order, is "For the world is hollow and I have touched the sky." I'm curious whether that was on your list.
That was on my list as well.
It almost didn't make my list. And I put it on the list for a very, very particular reason. In my mind, the oracle in that episode is very similar, or at least has shades of or connotes this idea of the panopticon, something you get from Jeremy Bentham or from Michel Foucault. This idea that you can, this omnivisibility, the idea that you're always being watched, always being observed, is a means of social control. And in this, you know, media rich age, when, you know, we've got our smartphones, we were always on the internet, we're always connected, we're always being observed. In other words, we're always turned on. We don't have that sense of isolation or privacy in our own homes or out in the world. You know, we're on 24/7 in this day and age. It's very similar to what I see in this episode, the idea that you can achieve social control by making people feel as if they're always observed. And that's a very scary, you know, fairly totalitarian way of interpreting the technology that we have around us. But this idea of social control through technology is very, very apt in this technology-rich society we live in. You know, in worst case scenario, it can lead to the Borg in Star Trek, right? The best case scenario, it's harmless and it's a means of communication, a means of interaction, a means of getting access to knowledge that you wouldn't have otherwise. But the dark side of that technology is the fact that we're on 24/7 and always, if not actively being observed, then we're always feel like we're being observed, or we're always turned on and we're always engaged. We're never unplugged. And that's what I see as the interesting connection to this episode.
Yeah, from a storytelling standpoint, I noted that as well. From a storytelling standpoint, I felt that it seemed very Orwellian, almost a 1984 kind of feel to it. There was this kind of ominous feeling of being watched from the very beginning of the episode. The old man comes in and begins to tell them that he had ventured out and he had, you know, telling what he had seen, and then all of a sudden he starts experiencing pain and then he collapses and dies. And so there's this ominous kind of feeling to the whole episode. But what really, certainly that point, but what really kind of drew my attention was the idea that these people were living in a manufactured reality. They weren't living really in a truth. In fact, there is this debate going on in the episode about truth. And one of the pieces of dialogue that really caught my attention is when she goes to the Oracle and she says truth, and these outsiders have told me the truth, and the Oracle is saying, you know, well, their truth, it's their truth. And she says, in essence, isn't a truth for all? And I thought that was a really interesting kind of philosophical thought right there that I think is applicable in certainly even today. This is one of those episodes that I think probably is as relevant today as it was in 1969 when they were telling the story initially. So this kind of whole manufactured reality that they were living in, you know, being just that, a manufactured reality, I thought that was really interesting philosophically.
Well, Mike, I think that's particularly apt now because we essentially live in a manufactured reality. Now, you know, as we're recording this, I'm sitting in my home office and I'm looking around. Everything I see around me is a manufactured object. We live in an age of video games and virtual reality and simulations. The economy can be simulated. My experience of learning something can be simulated. politics can be simulated. We just had an election. It looks like we had a simulation of politics or a simulacrum of politics. Mm-hmm. And I think in the age of media and in the age of virtual reality and in the age of manufactured objects, the industrial age and the information age and beyond, it becomes increasingly difficult to distinguish what is genuinely true, a true feature of reality apart from that simulation or apart from that manufactured aspect of our experience, and what is sort of built in, what is merely a simulation or merely, and when I say merely a simulation, I think of as a false simulation, right? What is a false feature that's being imposed on our sense of reality versus something true independent of our experience? And I think as our society gets increasingly media drenched, for lack of a better word, this is just going to be much more an increasing epistemic problem where it'll become increasingly difficult to distinguish something that's genuinely true apart from our experience that that is so saturated by media and inputs and manufactured things. The line between true and false and the line between is something true independent and something true because someone manufactured it to be true is blurred. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, because with that comes the ability to manufacture your own truth. You know, you can bring something into reality by making a new invention or coming up with a new idea, by conveying something out into the world in an interesting way. You can actually have, there's some creative power to change the world around you that comes with that. So I don't think of that as necessarily as Orwellian or as negative as it comes across inside this episode, but I think it certainly raises the this epistemic issue of whether it's possible to have truth in itself, you know, in the sense that Descartes was looking for in looking for mathematical certainty and knowledge, or in the sense that Kant was looking for in trying to ground his experience in something that is or give some objective account of his experience that unified his experience into something that was reliable for the sake of doing mathematics and scientific knowledge and whatnot. But I think in this day and age, that's just an unreasonable expectation. We can't always separate what has been manufactured from what is true independently.
Zachary, I'm curious, did you get a sense that they were playing a little bit in the world of Plato's cave, at least at the beginning of this episode?
Well, anytime anytime you're dealing with an imposed sense of reality, something that's merely an illusion, the issue of Plato's cave comes up. I mean, how do you know that your sense of reality, that what you're perceiving, that what your worldview is accurate, that it's not mere shadows on the wall, to use the metaphor of the allegory of the cave, literally. I mean, there's always this problem of how you can be sure of your perceptions and how you can know that you're not living in an insulatory epistemic bubble, so to speak. So yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you're dealing with any story about a manufactured experience, you're thrown right back into Plato's cave. And then the question is, what do you do about it? Do you just become comfortable living in the cave? Do you try to scratch at the surface and see if you can get it at reality? Does it take someone else to drag you out of your own perceptions to broaden your worldview? I think the wonderful thing about Plato's allegory of the cave in general is that it's just such a rich metaphor. It's a metaphor for our experience. It's a metaphor for education. It's a metaphor for government. It's a metaphor, you know, and it's a multi-layered allegory that is absolutely applicable to any number of these things. So yeah, I think that's the obvious connection to make, is in any time you have a sense of manufactured experience, then you might be living in Plato's cave. And I think that the disturbing thing that Descartes, the philosopher, latched onto is that how can we trust any of our experience then?
Yes.
How do we know we're not just living in the cave permanently, right? He was probably more of a skeptic than I think any of us need to be, but you know, absolutely. But I guess my ultimate point is just that there's a burden that comes along with that on us. I think the burden is to try to make sure that our perceptions are accurate and try our best to, you know, broaden our worldview and look for the assumptions that constrict our thinking and the parts of our perception that could be leading us astray and to false conclusions. I think, you know, the philosophical virtue is in the attempt, right? You never may never really know that you're not being deceived, that you're not you know, living in an illusory, you know, perception bubble, that your sense of reality is not being influenced by factors outside your control. But darn it, you can fight against that. You can claw your way out of the cave and try your best. So I think that's how philosophers think of themselves, as, you know, slowly crawling out of the cave into the into the light. And, you know, there's any number of obstacles in the way, and you're always kind of in the dark. And especially when that darkness is being imposed on you through technology and through, you know, the altering of your perceptions and through people who are manipulating you and whatnot. But darn it, we can fight against that. So I'm not as much of a skeptic as Descartes was, or even as Plato was, in a way. But I think, yeah, the allegory of the cave is just such a rich metaphor. Anytime you're dealing with altered perceptions or illusions, Plato's allegory of the cave is applicable. But then I think there's a burden to not just accept that, but to claw your way against it.
Well, I will say, I don't think in Plato's allegory of the cave there were such brightly colored technicolor plaid tunics on display anywhere. I'm quite certain. But at the beginning of the episode, I was immediately caught by the fact that the old man notices that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy were not, as he said, of Yanata. And Kirk responds by saying, "No, we're from outside your world." And he says, "Where is outside?" And immediately, you know, my mind went to the allegory of the cave. And I guess watching this again and really looking at it from strictly a philosophical point of view, I really thought that that was going to be the sum of this episode. But I have to say that the writing was very layered. It was very sophisticated, I think, for the time, and a very well-written episode. And I think it took some twists and some turns, I think, that were interesting. I think they raised some other really fascinating questions. They explored some ideas that I think went way beyond the allegory of the cave. But definitely that was a thread that I picked up on.
What you said there to me was really interesting. This idea of the aliens not recognizing that Kirk is outside of their reality in some way, that you're from outside. What does that mean? And I think whenever you encounter something that is contrary to your worldview, something that doesn't fit, you know, a piece of counter evidence, an experience, or whatnot, you kind of have two choices about how you can. Respond to that situation. One response is to try to incorporate the new experience or the thing that doesn't seem to fit into your worldview in some way. Like, oh, outside doesn't make sense. You must be part of my inside, part of my reality. How can I take this new information and incorporate it? And I think here in the real world, we encounter things that don't fit our worldview all the time. We encounter people who have other religions. We have people who have other political views, and, you know, they've got their evidence and their reasons and their experience. And what do you do with that? You can try to push it away and say, I don't understand what outside means, or you can try to incorporate it into your worldview in some way, modify your own worldview, modify your beliefs, or you can push against it and say, nope, I don't believe it. It's false. It doesn't match my worldview. I reject it outright. And I think we've seen plenty of examples in the real world of both approaches, but it raises to me this question of worldview that, you know, think of all the features of our experience, our assumptions and our previous experience, our beliefs. Some of those beliefs are more tightly held than others, but all of those, in my mind, are the backdrop against which we make our judgments. So when we encounter something new, like Kirk beaming down and all of a sudden, you know, these people don't know what to do with him. You know, who is this guy? He's from outside. What does that mean? It doesn't fit, right? I think oftentimes we just react, right? You know, it doesn't make sense, so I reject it. And it's just a subconscious, almost an emotional rejection of something. On the other hand, you can then go, wait a minute, my worldview doesn't match with this new experience. What do you do with that? And that's where I think philosophy can really add value, is taking the mismatch of assumptions. Your worldview meets something you don't understand. And how do you reconcile that? And I think that's where the hard philosophical work is. So it's very similar to the philosopher Wittgenstein in this sense of these unwritten, untalked about, implicit assumptions that we have and features of our experience that we have that connote that constitute our worldview. We're just constantly weighing everything against that. And so, you know, a few minutes ago, we were talking about this question of truth. The question is not, is something true in itself, or true independent of my experience, or true independent of being inside the cave of our perceptions. The question is, does this fit with my perceptions? The worldview and the assumptions that we have are the backdrop against which we make those judgments. So if you ask whether something is true, sometimes that doesn't mean, is it outside the cave, or is it true independently? Sometimes mm-hmm. that question can mean, is it true based on everything else I believe? You know, right. and that's what we're using as the measure of truth, because that's all we have, right? That's, you know, if we're stuck inside this world, you know, I'm stuck here on this planet with this body, with these sensory perceptions and these intellectual powers, and that's all I've got. So, you know, when I encounter a new piece of information, you know, I can't ask, is it true independent of me outside of that bubble? All I can do is say, does this fit or does this not fit with my worldview? And if it doesn't fit, I can try to incorporate it in some way, or I can reject it. But the base starting point of the process is, how does this relate to all the things I already believe, or all the things I already think I understand? And then it's a question of how you respond to that. So the question of truth in itself, I think, is a distraction from the process that actually does go on when we're asking whether something is true or not. You know, we might be intending to ask whether something is true in itself, but in reality, I think we're always just weighing our new experiences against our previous assumptions and our previous experiences, and doing our best inside the cave to wrestle with the new features of our experience and try to build a coherent worldview while being inside the cave to complete sure. the metaphor.
I think for Natira, I think the truth didn't fit with her own beliefs, her own ideas. And I think that she was weighing the evidence. There are three foreigners, one of which she has formed a nearly immediate bond with. She genuinely trusted McCoy. And so she couldn't just outright reject this truth that they had brought to her attention. And so she goes to the Oracle. And I love the argument that she makes. I think it's just a fascinating question. Isn't truth truth for all? And I think that's a really interesting question that she asks as she wrestles with whether or not, you know, this particular truth is going to fit into her own values or not. I just picked up on that. I thought it was fascinating.
Well, I don't want to spend the whole episode talking about this episode. Sure. We want to talk about other episodes. But I think while we're talking about truth, it's important to say, it's very easy to, I think, have the misunderstanding that truth means only one thing, that truth mm-hmm. generally means it's true and it's true independent. But truth can mean a number of different things. Truth can mean mathematical certainty. Truth can mean true for me individually, subjectively, my personal truth. Truth can mean a communal truth. You know, anyone who's living in a society with other people that has shared values, there's kind of a shared intersubjective truth. And this is a concept that kind of comes from the philosopher Immanuel Kant. This idea of intersubjectivity, that people who make the same judgments and have the same experiences and the same sensory perceptions, the same mental faculties, are going to make the same kinds of judgments. Communally, we're going to think certain things are true together. And so truth can mean any one of those things. So it's never just a question of what does truth mean? I think this is the mistake that Plato makes in the Allegory of the Cave, is thinking that truth is something fixed and eternal and unchanging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's five or six or seven different interpretations of the meaning of truth that are interesting. At least they're interesting sociologically, if not philosophically. And then the interesting question is, well, what do you say about that? Is there one and only one truth that's independent of all these societal factors and these subjective factors? Or do these other meanings of truth, these intersubjective and more subjective personal notions of truth, do these mean anything philosophically? Or are they a distraction from genuine truth with a big capital T, right? So again, I don't think we're going to settle that issue for sure, but I think it's you know, while we're talking about the nature of truth in the context of the allegory of the cave and in the context of this manufactured reality that we live in, it's very easy. It's important. I guess what I want to say is it's important not to fall into the trap of thinking that truth means one and only one thing. You know, that's what Plato thought, but other philosophers have thought different things about truth.
Sure, sure. Well, again, that was on my list as well. My list I actually have in order of air date from the third season. And so I'm going to begin with the first pick on my list based on the chronology of the air date, and that is Spock's brain. I know that this is not a popular episode with a lot of fans. However, you and I in episode 13 talked about this episode almost exclusively, entitled Spock's Pineal Gland. I really appreciate the way this episode kind of explores this idea of mind-body dualism. This is, once again, Zachary, we've had this conversation many times, and I really don't have much more to say other than, you know, what we discussed in episode 13 of Metatrex, kind of in the Wayback Machine there. But this is one of those great contradictions in the world of Star Trek, because there are times when consciousness is this emerging property, or at least it's portrayed as such. And then there are times in which you have Spock here, who, as Dr. McCoy describes him, is worse than dead. Although I don't know how you can be worse than dead.
Well, he's a zombie, a philosophical zombie.
He's a philosophical zombie.
Well, I say that half jokingly, because there is this view. There's a thought experiment kind of called the zombie thought experiment, or philosophical zombie thought experiment, that comes from a philosopher named David Chalmers, who basically posited that you can conceive a world exactly like ours, with all the physical properties, matter, particles moving around doing what they're doing, that is devoid of subjective experience, where, you know, there would be a being shaped like me and a being shaped like you sitting mm-hmm. here doing a podcast, but with no mental experience going on, purely in an automated kind of way based on whatever is going on at a physical level. And he says that's a coherent world. And, you know, if you can sort of mentally imagine a picture like that without any contradictions, that shows that it's in irony quotes, a logically possible world, a world that it doesn't have any doesn't have any contradictions in it. And so, because it's a theoretically possible world with no contradictions in it, doesn't contradict anything we seem to know about the laws of physics, that shows that conceptually, mental experience and physical properties are different things from each other. It's kind of a new argument for dualism that was given, you know, within the last 20 years or so. And, you know, so take an episode like Spock's brain. What does that mean? Is consciousness inherently tied to a brain or not? Does it arise out of what's in the brain? Is it independent from the brain in some sort of radically dualist way? And you see a lot of this in Star Trek with consciousness swapping in various ways and, mm-hmm. you know, consciousness being taken out of your body. And we see, for me, it's really interesting. I don't know why there's so much of this in Star Trek when Star Trek is otherwise so scientifically grounded in the physical world. Star Trek doesn't, you know, get into flights of fancy and, you know, spooky metaphysics all that much. It tries to avoid that in favor of scientific explanations. But that issue aside, it's an interesting question. What is consciousness? Is it tied to the physical world or not? Does it emerge out of the physical world? Is it conceptually separable from the physical world? So Spock walking around as if he's dead is very much what I picture when I think about David Chalmers' philosophical zombies, you know, people walking around, all the stuff we see in the world around us happening, you know, bodies of people moving around, talking to each other, but with no subjective experience, no mental content. Those are known in philosophy of mind as philosophical zombies. And it's an interesting thought experiment, whether that is logically possible, whether that idea itself contains a contradiction. And I guess if you're tied to this notion of emergence, that the consciousness emerges out of physical properties or emerges out of whatever's going on in the brain, mm-hmm. then you're going to say, wait a minute, that isn't actually an inconsistent picture, that whatever's going on in the brain necessitates a certain kind of emergent phenomenon, this thing we call consciousness, subjectivity and experience, whether that is logically a necessary consequence of whatever's going on at a physical level, or whether that's conceptually separable from that, so you can treat them separately like dualists want to do. It's an open question and an interesting one, and definitely one that Spock's brain raises, despite all of the flaws of that episode.
Yeah. Star Trek loves to have this conversation. You're exactly right. There are a ton of episodes where consciousness gets swapped or moved or, you know, whatever. We explore this quite a bit in Star Trek, but it's such a contradiction to other episodes in which they portray the idea of consciousness as being something that is emerging. And so, you know, once again, and I love the conversations that are going on in this episode with Spock, you know, like the one where, you know, they're saying to Spock, you know, we brought your body along with us.
Zombie Spock.
It's Zombie Spock.
Yeah, right.
yeah, exactly. And they're saying to Spock, oh, you know, well, we're going to put you back. And Spock says, back where? And Kirk says, back in your body. We brought it along with us. There's just for me, there's a comical element to it. And I don't look at this episode with disdain. I appreciate the storytelling. It's in many respects quintessential, although contradictory, Star Trek.
It's actually funny in my mind how things go from an original idea to becoming campy to becoming almost intolerable sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Spock's brain is a little hard to watch. I think, frankly, for me, dramatically, it doesn't really work. But it's easy to forget that at the time, no one had done a story quite like that. This was a unique kind of storytelling. And at the time, it captured everyone's imagination. And then it becomes cliche, something to laugh at. And then, you know, here we are, you know, 50 years late, almost 50 years later now. And, you know, we can kind of laugh at Spock's brain and all the problems with it. But, you know, just set the Wayback Machine to 47 years ago. And it was a novel idea that, you know, a lot of people hadn't been exposed to before. So I think episodes like this, as much as I like to criticize them and laugh at them and kind of do the Mystery Science Theater 3000 treatment on them and take pot shots, I really do enjoy the novelty of some of the stories that you get in Star Trek, even the ridiculous episodes of Star Trek that are kind of wildly implausible or not very scientifically plausible. But, you know, I think they add value philosophically. They get people thinking about ideas they hadn't thought of before. They bring to life these things that are, I mean, like the philosophical zombie thought experiment. If I said, Mike, close your eyes and think about a world that's like ours, except, you know, there's people walking around and reading newspapers and drinking cappuccinos or drinking coffee Janeway style, right? You know, but there's no mental content. But imagine those bodies didn't have any subjective experience and they were more like zombies or more like robots or more like whatever. Mm-hmm. And you kind of go, oh, okay, I can't really picture it. But then you go, okay, now let me give you Spock's brain and show you what that's like. You know, that brings those ideas to life. And I love that Star Trek does that. So yeah, I'm team Spock's brain. That episode doesn't really bother me. It's ridiculous in some ways, but it's so valuable for bringing these crazy ideas to life for people who haven't. For me, I have a background in philosophy, right? I studied in college. I used to teach philosophy. And so, sure, philosophical zombies, that doesn't even make me blink an eye, right? Sure, that's just something that's part of my vocabulary, part of my lexicon. But I think for people who haven't had that experience, haven't been exposed to those ideas, you can't just say, here, let me tell you about this crazy idea called philosophical zombies. They're going to, you know, throw things at you, you know, they roll their eyes at you. But, you know, you can put ideas in the context of a story like this and really get people entertaining ideas they wouldn't entertain otherwise. I think Spock's brain is like that.
Yeah, indeed. And just as a reminder to our listeners, if you want to hear a really great in-depth episode regarding Spock's brain and the nature of consciousness, go back to episode 13, Spock's by Neil Gland, and check it out. Next up, Zachary, I believe the ball, as they say, is in the dilithium is in your court.
Okay, so in no particular order, my next pick was Plato's Stepchildren. And this is also an episode that we've talked about previously on Metatrek. So if you want to hear us talk about Plato's Stepchildren in depth, come listen to us on Metatrek's episode 15, which we called The Philanthropist Negus, even though there are no Ferengi in Plato's Stepchildren. We thought that was a great title.
Yes.
But basically, in Plato's Stepchildren, the core thing that's going on there in my mind is the paradox of the philosopher king. You've got a group of aliens that have sort of adopted this Greek worldview based on having visited Earth in the past, and they have tried to recreate something like Plato's Republic with a philosopher king, except that the ruler in charge of the society is very much the antithesis of what a philosopher king would be, right? The one character that's a genuine candidate for a genuine philosopher king is Alexander. He doesn't seek power for his own sake. He is compassionate, has insights that the rest of the people in the society don't have, and he would be a good philosopher king, but he doesn't seek it. He is not in a position to have that authority. And I think this is just I think everyone can relate to this. This is the heart of the paradox of the philosopher king, that oftentimes it seems like the people who'd be best at being in charge of something either aren't in a position to, they're disenfranchised, or they don't want to be because they don't seek power. They're seeking truth for its own sake, or they're seeking something else. And so they never go out of their way to seek the power that's needed to rule a society. And so it does seem like the rulers that we end up with are not the most qualified, not the most intelligent, not the most benevolent, not the most qualified, in irony quotes, to be a genuine ruler in some benevolent sense. And I think this is especially salient now, right? We're just coming off the heels of a presidential election here in America. And, you know, that's the question. Who should our ruler be? What should their qualifications be? What kind of personality, what kind of temperament, what kind of experience, what kind of goals does that person have? And, you know, this is a, seems like a paradox in this day and age that sometimes it seems like the people who should be in charge never end up being. And sometimes, I guess my point is this has been a problem throughout the history of the world, right? You know, it was a problem for Plato in ancient Greece, and it's a problem for us today. It's a problem in Star Trek, you know, who should the president of the Federation be? Who should the captain of a starship be? What personality types seek out those roles and are willing to work to achieve power and hopefully will do something good with that power versus abusing that power. And so, again, I don't have any really conclusions to draw from this, but I think, you know, this, in a way, this is a little heavy-handed by calling this episode Plato's Stepchildren, but you know, as a way of talking about the paradox of the philosopher king and the question of legitimate authority. Mm-hmm. This is very heavy-handed. Let's just take Plato and put him in Star Trek, right?
Yes.
but I love it in a way. This is the kind of thing, again, you only get these kinds of stories in Star Trek. What if there are these aliens and they've adopted this ancient Greek society, and you know, it really exposes people to these ideas they wouldn't be exposed to otherwise. You know, again, it's one of these things where, like, oh yeah, if you studied philosophy in college or you took, you know, political science or government, and you know, the idea of Plato and the philosopher king and Plato's Republic is part of your vocabulary. But if it's not, this is a way of getting exposure to these really profound ideas about political philosophy. You know, the question of authority and legitimate authority, and what we're looking for in rulers, and what makes a good ruler versus a bad ruler. And these are questions that we do have to deal with in the real world. And I love that Star Trek has found a way to incorporate ancient Greek philosophy with actual questions about legitimate authority that are constantly salient in any age for any group of people in any society, and combine them all together into an interesting dramatic story. And I think Star Trek does that exceptionally well in a way that you just don't get in other franchises. So Plato's Stepchildren, it's corny in a lot of ways. You know, again, it kind of has the same, it's the Spock's brain problem, right? It's a corny episode in a lot of ways, like a lot of the things you see in season three of the original series. But it adds so much value in being able to have these kinds of discussions that you wouldn't have otherwise. And I guess what I mean to say is that part of the value I see of Star Trek in general is a type of education for people. Not everyone has a college degree, and not everyone has exposure to philosophical ideas, and not everyone makes connections between what's happening in the world and what they're seeing on television. And Star Trek can take these ideas, combine them together, give you an interesting dramatic story, and help educate people about the deep issues that we all have to face. You know, we all have to figure out who our ruler should be and what their qualifications should be, and who we're going to vote for, right? You know, coming on the heels of an election. But I just think of Star Trek as serving so much value. And Plato's Stepchildren, you can laugh it off as a ridiculous episode of Star Trek, right? Oh my God, ancient Greek gods in space. What is going on here? But if you dig just a little deeper and realize, oh, wait a minute, this is a way of getting at these timeless ideas that go all the way back to ancient Greece and beyond. And it brings it to life in a story that's fun and entertaining. I quite enjoy it. So Plato's Stepchildren is on my list for this season.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. It's one of the things that I genuinely love about Star Trek is they have the ability to take Plato and put him in his ideas in a science fiction story, frame it up, and you know, you've got really great storytelling. I have to say that Michael Dunn, the actor that played Alexander, really stole the show as far as, you know, the more surface things, the acting and so forth. What Alexander lacked in stature, he made up for in character. And this was on my list as well, Zachary. And you mentioned episode 15 of Metatrex, The Philanthropist Negus. I would also like to say that we covered this on an episode of The Ready Room not so long ago, episode 206, entitled The Flamenco Stunt Dancer, in which I had the opportunity to join Christopher Jones and our art director, Aaron Harvey, as well as Andy Vanderkalk. And we talked about this episode in great length. So listeners should go back and check that out as well. Two fantastic episodes in which we dissected this particular episode of the original series from two different perspectives. Had a lot of fun doing it.
Doesn't Plato in space sound like something from the Muppets? Plato in space. Maybe not.
So who would play the part of Alexander? Would that be Beaker or
I don't know. I have no response. I don't know. Sorry, you got me. You stumped me.
So Zachary, as I said, Plato's Stepchildren was on my list as well. So that's three of my episodes. I'm down to my last two. And so next on my list would be The Cloudminders. I really enjoy this episode for a lot of reasons. I think there's a really interesting exploration of political philosophy in this episode. I think it deals with some interesting sociology issues, the idea of class and some of the philosophical issues that are raised there. So you have the two classes of people here. You have the folks who are down on the surface in the mines. Then you have the people who are living up there in Cloud City. It kind of takes on a Star Wars kind of.
Wait, are they living on Cloud Nine?
On Cloud Nine, Cloud City, Bespin. There, I don't think they called that city Bespin, but there they are. They're up in the clouds, and they very much remind me of the Platonians from Plato's Stepchildren, where their life is consumed with beauty and art, and they almost don't even notice that the people down below them. They notice their existence, but they're just not interested, and labor is beneath them. And in fact, they refer to those people in the mines in this episode in the 1960s, of course, as retarded. And of course, we come to understand later on in the episode that there is a odorless, colorless gas that's being emitted in the mines that renders an effect on these people that leave them somewhat stumped intellectually. So I think there's a really interesting kind of political philosophy woven into this. It asks some really good questions about class, and it dissects sociology to some degree. And I really appreciate near the end of the episode, Droxine, played by Diana Ewing, really finds herself questioning the reality, the existence that she lives, and realizing that there is a much bigger world out there. And, she refers to her life almost as a prison. And, suddenly her world, Zachary's been enlarged. So yeah, I think there's a lot of really fascinating explorations going on in this episode.
Whenever you've got a division between the ruling class and the working class, you're almost forced into talking about Karl Marx and Marxism.
Yes.
Here we've got what is essentially the uprising of the proletariat, the working class, being aware of the situation they've been put in. And, throughout history, you can find examples of the ruling class trying to find ways of pacifying the working class, right, in order to maintain their own positions of power, to maintain their influence. Going back to ancient Rome, you can, it's bread and circuses, right? Mm-hmm. Put people in the Colosseum, give them food, give them a spectacle, and they're happy, and they go home, and they don't launch a rebellion against you. They don't try to conquer your empire. In the industrial age that Marx was writing in and beyond, here in the information age, it can often be a question of the authenticity of your labor, right? Are you working in a job that is authentic, that makes good use of your talents, that is personally satisfying, that you feel good about at the end of the day? Or are you slaving away at a job that is not personally authentic, that someone else is benefiting from all the fruits of your labor and you get no satisfaction, either material satisfaction, being able to keep the fruits of your own labor? And Marx was very concerned with material satisfaction. He's known as a materialist because he had very much emphasized, if you work, you should be able to keep the fruits of your labor. And, mm-hmm. In a capitalist society, we hand over the fruits of our labor to someone else and we get second skimmings,
yes,
so to speak. But, in my mind here in the 21st century, why is this relevant to us? I think it's very easy to be pigeonholed into your role in society, the job that you do day in, day out. And you can, what do you do about that? You can be dissatisfied to the point where you're ready to revolt against the entire system because you think it's radically unfair. You can try to find a way to embrace your situation and find fulfillment in what you're doing. You can try to change your situation, get new skills, try to find something that's more personally authentic. But I think there's, in reality, what happens a lot of the times is that there is an attempt to kind of pacify the people at the bottom. And I think we do it in various ways in our society. They did it in ancient Rome. And, you know, it's spectacles and it's entertainment. And, you know, Marx quoted, this is taken way out of context by a lot of people, but Marx said that religion is the opiate of the masses, right? That's a, you know, that's interesting translation of Marx's phrase there. But, you know, people find various ways of finding fulfillment in their current situation without becoming aware of what's going on around them, above them, literally above them. In this case, it's the clouds, right? and I love the spatial metaphors, right? It's not just literally above, you know, here on Earth, it's a metaphor, right? People are above me in society or above me in terms of power, influence,
and whatnot. It's a very effective metaphor.
And here they've taken that metaphor, this idea that people are above you, and they've brought it to life, made it literal in Star Trek. This people in the clouds are literally above me, keeping me down, right? So I love that this is, you know, Marxism through and through, brought to life by taking those metaphors and making them literal inside this episode of Star Trek. It's a really wonderful episode.
Yeah. Spock makes the observation. He says, this troubled planet is a place of the most violent contrast. He said, those who receive the rewards are totally separated from those who shoulder the burdens. And he observes, it's not a wise leadership. And in fact, in the episode, Droxine begins to draw a contrast as well. Her father, who is trying desperately to shield her from what he knows is the reality of what is going on in their society. And she turns to him as she's leaving to go to her music, as he says, you go to your music. I don't, you know, go to your pleasures, go to your, you know, your cultured way of life, and don't look at, you know, the dirty reality of what's going on here. And she turns to him and she says, Father, are we so sure of our methods that we never question what we do? And this, Zachary, is Star Trek's way of questioning something that, at least in the world of 1969, was a serious issue. We were at the height of the Cold War, and communism, Marxism was still very relevant in Europe, and particularly in the Soviet Union and Russia. And, you know, here they are asking the question, is this wise leadership? And Spock observes, no, it's not. When there is such a violent contrast here in the ruling class and the working class, and those who are doing the work and shouldering the burdens aren't receiving the rewards. That's just not wise leadership. And what a bold way. And again, we're talking about very complex political philosophies there, and we're asking hard questions. And it's something that I really applaud Star Trek through and through for doing.
Well, I think it's interesting that Star Trek is dealing with this issue in the 1960s when communism was such a looming specter. I think, you know, how you interpret this consideration, this fictional interpretation of Marxism is a question of political philosophy, right? On the one hand, you can interpret this as, oh my God, communism is bad because it threatens all of our ideals of capitalism, individuality and autonomy and, democratic society and whatnot. On the other hand, you can view it as a way of empowering people who have been disenfranchised and held down by the people who are literally above them inside the episode. So I find it really, frankly, interesting. I think this is a fairly charitable interpretation of communism and Marxism in the 1960s, especially given that so much of the time Star Trek pits itself against communism, against what, I mean, the Klingons are a metaphor for the Soviet Union in the 1960s, right? And here we have Star Trek that I think of this episode as being a fairly charitable interpretation of the empowerment of people who've been kept down by people above them in some sort of Marxist, communist kind of way. You know, we're all Americans here, so I don't think communism is the ideal form of government, but I think this is just a surprisingly charitable interpretation of communism, given that Star Trek oftentimes pits itself as very adversarial to the embodiment of communism in the 20th century, the Soviet Union, by putting, you know, making them, ugly Klingons that have an attitude problem in the 60s. You know, that's how Star Trek generally deals with communism. But here we see a very different take on the situation that's much more friendly to the uprising of the proletariat, to use the Marxist vernacular.
Indeed. All right. Well, Zachary, that is the Cloud Minders. That's certainly the reason why I think you articulated as well, the very, very much why I think this deserves to be a philosophy essential for the third season of the original series. What's next on your list?
Okay, next on my list is Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
That was one of my, on my initial list of nine, that, I would call that an honorable mention. Yeah, it's a great episode.
And I hesitated to put this on my list because, you know, generally we try to make Metatreks about Star Trek and philosophy. And this is not, frankly, the most philosophically rich episode. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly heavy-handed, fairly obvious piece of social commentary that somehow managed to work its way past the censors because in true Gene Roddenberry fashion, Gene Roddenberry took a social issue like racism, put, you know, the centerpieces of that debate in outer space with funny makeup on a spaceship. And lo and behold, it got by the censors and you can get your message out there in the world. So this is Star Trek through and through. And I would be totally remiss if I didn't put this on the episode, because this episode, more than I think any other episode of Star Trek for me, totally captures Star Trek's ability to take a controversial issue that is emotionally charged, that is difficult to get people to deal with rationally, and put it in outer space so our emotions aren't stirred by our everyday situation, and can draw our emotions a totally different way or influence people's judgment about the contemporary situation based on what they're seeing in a fanciful fiction science fiction show. So this is just the Star Trek MO for how to deal with social commentary in its purest form. And I could not talk about the season three of the original series without putting this on my list. So of course, this is the episode where the aliens, you know, there's aliens that are half black and half white and their faces are painted, right? You know, one half is black, one half is white. And they're totally racist against people who have their colors reversed. And it's a brilliant, again, a little heavy-handed way of saying, look, racism is ridiculous. There's nothing different about you. Your colors are just swapped, you know. And I think in any age where there's a looming sense of racism or intolerance, and we're dealing with that now. We've got Islamophobia, right? You know, there's you know, you can look at the situation and go, this is ridiculous. People are people. People are just like you. So what about skin color? So what about religious belief? So what about, you know, about any contingent feature of being a human being? All of that is surface level. And when you get down below the surface, we're all in the same situation. We're here in the world together. We all have to have the same basic needs met. We all have the same desires and needs and whatnot. And look how ridiculous all of this racist stuff and all this fear looks when you look at it from this standpoint. And I think, frankly, that was relevant in the 60s. It's relevant to us in a new way. And it's a message that's desperately needed. You know, I think practically here in the real world, we all need to see each other as people, and we need to see each other as equals. And this question of racial superiority or class superiority or being afraid of people who are different than you, that is something Star Trek is very active at fighting against in Gene Roddenberry's worldview, and especially, you know, later in Star Trek with his more developed worldview. But you can see the seeds of it here, that you can take a controversial issue like this, and that is emotionally charged for a great many people, put it in outer space, that pacifies the situation here in the real world, get your emotions stirred in a different way, get you looking at how ridiculous some of the interpersonal and social and political issues that we have here in the real world can be when looked at, you know, from a neutral standpoint. You know, if you looked at an alien race that had all of our problems, we'd say, God, how stupid those people are. Right? And then we look at our own world and we get so immersed in these problems and so emotionally charged about them. And I think there's never been a time, frankly, especially given what we've seen in the last 18 months with the politics in this country, you know, people need to, you know,
very be able divisive.
To put, yeah, people need to be able to put their problems in perspective and see other people as people and come together and realize that a lot of these problems are self-created and they're ridiculous when you look at it from the perspective of you know, what an alien race might see if they were looking at us, or what we might see if an alien race had the same problems that we have. And Star Trek is I think it's just to be commended that it was able to get away with it in the 60s, that it's just as relevant today as it was then in different ways. And, you know, we just could not talk about season three of the original series without talking about this particular episode, because I think this really does embody Star Trek, the best of what Star Trek can do in dealing with these kinds of relevant issues. And I think getting people to pull their intuitions and pull their emotions in a way that they may not do if you gave them an analogous situation here in the real world. And sadly, too much of the time, I think we let ourselves be stirred emotionally by the issue at hand, our fears and our intolerance and our sense of ourselves viewing other people as not the same as ourselves. And, you know, it just looks ridiculous. Like Captain Kirk points out in this episode, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, an episode of the Star Trek like this can take someone who has that intolerant view and get them to see that ridiculousness in themselves, that their intuitions are not serving them at their best. And, again, this is not philosophy per se, but I guess at the end of the day, I think that there's a danger of viewing Star Trek as this outdated show from the 1960s, where the issues in the 60s aren't relevant to us today, and those cheap blinky lights they put on plywood, as Larry Nemechek pointed out last time. Christmas lights on plywood, as Larry Nemechek put it on last time in episode 47 of Metatreks. All of that is a distraction. There's a timelessness to the messages of Star Trek. This social commentary about racism in the 60s is relevant to us today. It'll be relevant in 100 years. God willing, we'll get beyond these problems someday and we'll be able to achieve the kind of, you know, radically coherent, more tolerant, unified type of society that's part of the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek worldview. But here today we live in the real world and these are real problems. And an episode like this is to me just as important today, maybe even more important today than it was back in the 1960s. So it's just commendable that Star Trek was able to get away with it. And I hope people don't forget about the importance of these messages. And frankly, forgetting that this kind of social commentary is an important part of Star Trek as a whole. Last time you and I spoke about our hopes for Star Trek Discovery, I hope that Star Trek finds a way of having this kind of a story with this rich of a message, even if it's heavy-handed, mm-hmm. to use science fiction as an allegory for the contemporary situation that pulls our emotions and pulls our intuitions in a way that helps us try to see the better parts of ourselves and helps us see that our intolerances and our faults and the struggles that are here in the real world are... it's contingent. They're not necessary. That they look ridiculous from a third person standpoint, and I think all of that helps us be the best versions of ourselves if we think of it in those terms.
Yeah, as I said, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield was on my short list, and I pulled it off because, as you said, and you're right, it was just a little light philosophically. And the reason it probably made my list was the kind of social aspect of it. It's willing to take on what in its time was a very serious issue. I mean, this is 1969, Zachary, literally the year before. There was this attempt to silence the civil rights movement by putting a bullet in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so this was a very, very big hot button issue in 1969, and it still is today. This is one of those episodes when I'm talking to people who aren't necessarily fans of Star Trek, when we're talking about the original series, this is one of those episodes that always comes up in the conversation. They remember this duochromatic species and, you know, this idea of taking on racism. And while it was cutting edge in its time, there are elements of this episode that, looking at it here in 2016, it's almost funny because while they are taking on the racism that exists between, you know, these two beings, you know, one has black on the right, the other is black on the left, and so on and so forth. And they're taking on the racism that exists between them. I think it was Scotty or perhaps Captain Kirk that pointed out that, you know, you guys look exactly alike. And that seems like an almost insensitive statement. You all look alike. So it's what
an alien would say if they came, you know, if there were extraterrestrials and they came to Earth and they looked at us, they'd go, oh yeah, some of you are black, some of you are white, some of you are different colors, and
but you're all,
in the middle.
You all look alike.
You all kind of look the same to me, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly the perception an alien species would have about us. And it's funny to see it in reverse. Like, you guys look, from our human standpoint, you guys look exactly the same. What's the issue?
You are all ugly bags of mostly water.
Exactly.
Indeed. So yeah, this was on my short list as well, but I did pull it off, and I have come to my last episode on my list, because again, you and I agreed on two of them so far. So my last episode is the last episode of Star Trek, the original series, Turnabout Intruder. And when we were talking about Spock's brain, we were talking about why Star Trek brings up this, you know, these types of stories so often. You know, here's an episode where, you know, a woman who desired to be a starship captain. She wanted to break the glass ceiling, as it were, break the space ceiling, as it were, and be a starship captain. And she wasn't able to do that.
Captain Janeway, she was not.
She was not Captain Janeway by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, she did very much want to be a starship captain. And she, for a lot of reasons, she had a lot of disdain for Captain Kirk, who, you know, he loved her and he left her. And so...
Who, Kirk?
not Kirk.
I don't believe it.
Not Kirk. So Dr. Lester, she's a very bitter person, and she's going to do whatever it takes. So what she does, she manages to come up with a means of switching consciousness with Captain Kirk. So she places her consciousness in his body, and then Captain Kirk, of course, gets in touch with his feminine side and enters her her body. And so I think one of the reasons, to answer the question that you asked earlier about, you know, why does Star Trek explore this storyline so often? I think some of it comes with the fascination of, you know, this question of, you know, what's it like to be a bat? What's it like to be a cat? What's it like to be Captain Kirk? And I think that's Janet Lester's great question. You know, instead of what's it like to be a bat, she wants to know what's it like to be Captain Kirk. And she gets to experience that a little bit. But, you know, she's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, so it doesn't really end well for her. But again, at the end of the day, you know, it's one of those episodes, again, where we're exploring the nature of consciousness and, you know, that whole mind-body dualism thing that Star Trek has a tendency to weave into its storylines. But again, it explores this idea of what is it like to be, and at least in this case, it was a woman saying, what is it like to be a man? And I think, again, for the time that this was written, I think it was cutting edge storytelling that I think broadened the dialogue in America at a critical time when women were finding themselves in a whole new way in society.
This is such a strange episode because it's like gender politics meets spooky dualism. It's such a weird episode. You know, definitely there's the gender empowerment component to this. And, you know, and the way you've characterized it puts this episode firmly in the second wave of the feminist movement as it's characterized these days. The first wave being the suffrage movement, essentially. Mm-hmm. The second wave being women in the workforce and empowerment, glass ceiling kind of stuff. And the third wave being how to have all of the stuff of the second wave movement, but do it in a more personally authentic way where women don't just have to turn themselves into men to get ahead, right? The way you've characterized it, that Janice Lester essentially wants to become Captain Kirk, the what is it like to be Captain Kirk question, what is it like to be, not a man necessarily, what is it like to be captain of a starship, but she has to essentially turn herself into Captain Kirk, literally, in this episode. So, you know, I think of this, it's an interesting dabble into gender politics of the early part of the second wave feminist movement, but, you know, clearly I think it lacks a little bit of the contemporary perspective on gender equality and neutrality and the subtlety of gender politics. And this is a little heavy-handed and it's a little obvious and it's a little simplistic. And I think most people these days think it's, you know, the attempt of women to become more masculine in order to be able to serve alongside men. Kind of like what you see with Tasha Yar in Star Trek: The Next Generation, right? She's fairly masculine, and they kind of dabble. You know, Tasha Yar, she's got a short haircut, and she's tough, but she's still feminine. And they kind of, you know, not sure how to deal with that. Even as late as the 1980s, they don't know how to quite deal with that. And I see the as the, these two episodes of of Star Trek, this episode ending the original series and the beginning of The Next Generation is kind of bookending that second wave feminist movement. And then along comes Captain Janeway, who is feminine and is much more authentic. It doesn't have to be a man. And, you know, a lot of those gender politics issues were on their way to moving into that third wave of feminism by the time the 90s roll around. And the difference between Janet Lester and Tasha Yar and then later feminine characters in Star Trek is a stark contrast. I think it just shows the evolution of gender politics in this country, you know, on the small screen, the silver screen.
Zachary, I will, if I may, throw a plug in for Star Trek Continues. They did an episode, their most recent episode entitled Embracing the Winds, I think really is a sequel to some degree to Turnabout Intruder. And in that episode, Kirk has to choose between Spock and a competing female officer for captaincy of another starship. But in the course of determining whether it will be Spock or Commander Garrett taking that that captaincy, issues of competence and the role of gender issues really cause some problems. And so there's a hearing. Erin Gray makes a fantastic appearance in this episode of Star Trek Continues. And in that hearing, they basically lay the groundwork for what will eventually pave the way for women in the captaincy. So, you know, for Star Trek fans out there who are saying, you know, okay, I'm a canonista, if I can borrow Larry's term there, I'm a canonista. So how did we get from here to there? Well, I think you should go check out Star Trek Continues Embracing the Winds. It's a fantastic episode where, again, I think they continue the dialogue here from Turnabout Intruder and really bring it into our own time and beyond. So that was my last pick, Zachary. I believe you have a couple more over there.
Yeah, I've got two more, and I should give a little caveat. I actually really struggled a bit to come up with my list of essential Trek philosophy episodes from season three of the original series. And I worry a little bit that maybe I just picked episodes that happen to be appealing to me today. That if you ask me in a week, I might pick something different. I might latch onto a different thread. So that's my caveat, that there's, you know, this is a big asterisk next to these picks. That
well, and as we've always said, this is never the final answer. And there are plenty of great episodes in season three of the original series. And again, I'd love to hear from our listeners as well, find out what their picks were. I don't think there are any right or wrong answers here, and I think it's important our listeners know that.
So number four on my list was The Lights of Zatar.
Mm.
And again, it's not my favorite episode of Star Trek by a long shot, but I was really captivated by this notion of memory alpha, this sort of Star Trek's version of an Encyclopedia Galactica. And this is something that comes right out of the 1960s, the whole notion of an Encyclopedia Galactica, that, you know, as we learn more and more and more, we should try to have this repository of all this knowledge, so preserve it all for future generations, learn as much as we can. You know, it raises some interesting epistemic questions for me. It seems to confuse knowledge with wisdom, with information. So if you just keep stockpiling information, cultural and scientific information, that's going to make us better and better and better as a society. You know, forgetting that experience matters and forgetting that wisdom matters, forgetting that other people's experiences matter. And I don't have any deep conclusions about this episode. In fact, this is kind of a minor thread of the episode. I just found it particularly interesting that, in the 1960s, and in other words, at the beginning of the information age, as we know it now, there was an obsession with information, that the more information we get, the smarter we're going to be, and we should preserve it all. And Star Trek has its version of the Encyclopedia Galactica in Memory Alpha.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this episode. I like this episode. I like it a lot. It's funny that I didn't really associate the Memory Alpha thread with this particular episode. I'm glad you kind of latched onto that, because again, it's not something that was really on my radar. It's kind of a minor thread, as you said, in the episode. But this is a fantastic episode. So Zachary, I believe you have one more episode on your list.
Yes. So the last episode on my list is The Mark of Gideon.
Mm.
And again, I kind of hesitated to put this on my list. I think part of my MO in putting this list together was not coming up with the obvious picks. I wanted to try to find some threads that aren't the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. But one of the threads I found in this episode is the thread of overpopulation and what you do about it. You know, we've got a practical problem here in the real world about overpopulation. Our world is getting more and more crowded. We're doing environmental damage. We run the risk of not having enough clean water to go around and whatnot. What do you do about that? Mm-hmm. And it's, in my mind, this episode raises an interesting question of how you balance individual liberties versus social good. You know, do we do things like forced sterilizations in order to limit the population growth, or does that violate certain rights that we think are innate, people's freedom to choose how to reproduce and live their own lives and whatnot? So again, this is a bit of a, I don't want to say it's a minor thread, it's a part of the episode, but I think it's a very relevant issue. You know, we in the real world have to decide, what do we do about our increasing population in the world and all the problems that it causes? Do we try to address it in some heavy-handed way? I mean, they tried this in China, right? You know, limiting reproductive rights and whatnot. Or do we not allow those things and just let the population continue to grow and grow and grow? So I think there's a practical problem here, but it also raises a question of values, how you pit the individual rights of people versus the common good and the things that are necessary to preserve common good, and whether those violate rights or not. So I think the overpopulation issue is really an interesting thread. It raises these ethical dilemmas, pits our intuitions against each other, and forces us to ask the question, what do we do in this day and age? And it was an issue in the 60s. They thought overpopulation was an issue, and here we are 50 years later, and it's an even bigger issue. So this will only get to be a more important of an issue, but it does raise this question: how do you go about addressing the issue? Do you try to deal with it in some way and, you know, accept all the consequences, sterilizations and whatnot, or do you just accept the fact that we're going to grow and grow and grow, and accept all the environmental damage and the poor quality of living that comes along with an overpopulated world? I think it's an incredibly practical issue that this episode raises.
It does raise a lot of, and again, this is why I think season 3 of Star Trek, the original series, is really so much better than a lot of, not all fans, but a lot of fans give it credit for, because again, we're taking on really what was in its time a considerable issue. We were asking these questions and we were looking for answers, and Star Trek was bold enough to address these things in its time with really what I think is just very pointed, sharp cutting, two-edged kind of dialogue that really isn't bashful about, you know, taking these hard issues on. I think that this episode is a little light on the philosophy, but again, for when you're talking about the social issues, I think it's just a powerful, hard-hitting episode, and definitely is on one of my favorites list. And again, just looking at it sheerly from, you know, a surface kind of standpoint, I think this episode has some really strong performances, particularly from David Hurst, who plays Ambassador Hoden. I think gave a really great performance in this episode, as well as the members of the regular cast. So I can certainly see why it made your list.
Well, we as people sometimes can't see past our own nose. Hell, in politics, we can't see past the next election, right? Mm-hmm. Much less 50 years or 100 years or 1,000 years in the future. And I think what I love about taking issues like overpopulation and putting them in Star Trek, in space, in the future, is that it forces us to ask, well, that could be us someday. What happens to us 50 years or 100 years or 1,000 years? You know, if we can look past our own nose and realize that there are future people, our descendants, who are going to have to deal with these issues, and those issues are only going to get worse. Star Trek does a pretty admirable job of taking contemporary issues and amplifying them and saying, hey, wait a minute, if we're continuing on our current trend, this is the kind of situation that we're looking at. And again, you know, it's not necessarily the point of the episode per se, but I think it's some of the virtue that an episode like this has, you know, using stirring our imaginations to look past ourselves and look, you know, imagine what the future world will be like if we're continuing on a certain trend. And Star Trek does that in a lot of different ways. So, you know, it's projection of there being a World War III because of eugenics, right? I mean, mm-hmm. fast forward in the future, what would that world be like? And, you know, again, if we don't stop to think about what trajectory we were on and what the to use a phrase Spock might use, what the logical result of our current trajectories will be, you know, we can put future humans in a very bad position. So again, I just like the fact that this episode raises an issue that was relevant then. It's more relevant now. It'll be even more relevant in 100 more years. And, you know, Star Trek does a great job of forcing us to think beyond our own noses. And I like this episode for that reason.
I do as well. Well, to recap for our listeners, Zachary, our philosophical essentials are as follows. For the world is hollow, and I have touched the sky. Spock's brain. Plato's stepchildren. The Cloudminders. Let that be your last battlefield. Turnabout intruder. The lights of Zatar. And the mark of Gideon. That, listeners, is Metatrek's Philosophical Essentials, Star Trek The Original Series, Season 3.
I really enjoy seeing how our lists overlap. You know, without fail, we have some differences and some overlapping picks when we do Essential Trek philosophy. And it's just fun to see where our different intuitions go and the different threads you can find in Star Trek. And what's fun about this, I think if you asked, you know, 10 different people or 20 different people to pick their top five philosophically rich episodes, they'd pick very different picks. You know, there's an element of subjectivity to what we find interesting in these episodes. And I think I learn more about us when we have these conversations than I do necessarily learn anything about Star Trek per se. Always fun to do an episode of Essential Trek Philosophy, though, and it was fun to rewatch season 3 of the original series. I haven't revisited it in a while, and like I said, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so, you know, for me, even though I watched Star Trek with my dad when I was a little kid, Star Trek for me more often connotes you know, Star Trek in the 90s and beyond. So it was fun to have a reason to go back and spend some time on the original series again. But Essential Trek Philosophy from season 3 of Star Trek The Original Series isn't the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
Some races are like Talaxians. We really don't know how long they've kind of been around.
Char, what? I just had a great idea. I need to calm myself down. I need some
Breathe.
Ice. I need
Breathe.
Some ice.
Okay. Okay, rest your head.
Okay.
Easy. In All right. And out.
Warp 5.
What's your favorite episode of Enterprise?
I usually say Strange New World. The first part of Strange New World just reminds me so much of being a kid and growing up in southeastern Oklahoma and the mountains and the woods. And I just imagine what it would be like to go camping on an alien planet.
Meta Trex.
After 150 years of sitting around in the mud, that's got to be one relaxed symbiont.
But there again, it shows that, at least for the symbiont on Trill, that there's life beyond the mud.
Life beyond the mud, I love it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar of the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
And on Facebook, it is facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, check out our listeners-only discussion group, The Babel Conference. Just type The Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTrex on iTunes. We'd really love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not working your way through your Memory Alpha reading list, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, certainly on Facebook, that's where I'm most active. Also on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when your brain is not on loan to the controller, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on the network?
Well, likewise, you can find me on Facebook, especially in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for MetaTrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter under the handle @MagicDrop5. And we'd like to thank Kay Shaw, and you can find her under the Twitter handle @ChocoWeeble. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.